From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by DataPipe Managed IT Services, delivering a comprehensive suite of managed services, including implementing, securing, and scaling applications designed for mid-market and Fortune 1000 enterprises. DataPipe.com.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The announcement had been rumored for weeks, but the specific details were the subject of widespread media speculation. When the news finally came, frenzy. Never mind to the front pages of USA Today, Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, and The Washington Post. Never mind the evening news, Nightline, and the blogosphere. The news was everywhere. Talk about surge. This was a surge.
We got the first look today at the new must-have device.
It's an iPod. It's a phone. Is this man Superman?
Apple CEO Steve Jobs said his company will introduce a new phone that does just about everything.
I don't know what it is, but I want it.
You didn't think I was talking about Iraq, did you? No, the hottest story of the week wasn't how President Bush pitched a plan to escalate the war. It was Apple's new iPhone, unveiled with the usual extravagant lights, sound, and hyperbole at the annual Macworld Expo. Wired Online's columnist Pete Mortensen was there.
At about 9 in the morning, James Brown comes on with I Feel Good. The crowd sort of starts rumbling. There are gigantic video screens all over the place. The lights dim, and Steve Jobs emerges. People go nuts. And he goes into what his typical script for introducing products is. He talks a little bit about the success Apple has had, touches on existing products a little bit, and then starts heading toward new stuff. In particular, this time, there was the Apple TV, which was previously announced as the ITV last fall. It was expected. People knew about this. Then he stops silent, the screen fades, and an Apple logo inspired by the monolith from 2001, A Space Odyssey, comes on the screen. I don't think they started playing Also Sprach Zarathustra, but it wouldn't have been out of place. And he says, "Welcome. We're going to make some history today." And everybody in the audience buys it. The people who are paying to be there and therefore have a greater vested stake in believing this, the people who are friends with Apple and just want to believe it, and the journalists who are there not to believe it. And he then says, Apple has an amazing tradition of introducing truly revolutionary products. And today we're going to introduce three such products. And there are gasps all over. He says, first, we're going to bring out a widescreen iPod. Second, a revolutionary new phone. And third, a breakthrough communications device for the internet.
And of course, it isn't three products, but in fact, it's one product. It's the iPhone. When the 2,000 journalists are standing there in the midst of this frenzy, what happens to their skepticism?
As soon as he held up the actual iPhone, it all dropped away, and everyone wanted one. It's embarrassing, but you can't help but feel sucked into it.
You actually write a column devoted to the whole idea that Apple isn't so much a company as a cult with a ticker symbol. How does a company achieve this status? Is it because they're masters of presentation or just because they consistently deliver the goods?
It's all of the above, and it's also a third piece, which is that they're massively secretive. So essentially, they tend to let journalists, pundits, and their fans do all of their PR for them. I'm told that neither Google nor Yahoo, who worked intimately on software for the iPhone, ever saw it until Jobs introduced it. I still wasn't convinced there was going to be an iPhone. And if there hadn't been, I think you would have seen Apple's stock plummet yesterday. But because there was, the entire world went nuts with the claim.
In the end, this is really, it's a business story. Even Enron had a hard time finding its way to page one. Do you find yourself marveling at how the mainstream press can get so completely hooked?
I do to a certain extent, but I also think that the fascination is a very simple one. Apple is one of a handful of American companies that is still looked at as the leader in its field. For numerous other fields, companies in Asia and Europe are out in front. So when Apple, started by a pair of good American boys, gets up and does something that really knocks back those kinds of competitors, Americans are out of their seat. It's an amazing story.
In fairness, the iPod was a genuinely revolutionary product. So I guess the press could be forgiven for at least giving this guy a good listen.
And perhaps because they did underestimate the iPod when it was introduced. I remember in early 2001, Steve Jobs announced that he was going to bring forth a breakthrough digital device. And people got really excited. Was this going to be a teleportation box? You know, they were just going wild. And then he brought it out and it was an MP3 player. And not only was it an MP3 player, it was a $500 MP3 player. And the world just rolled its eyes. And 6 years later, it really has changed multiple industries. So I think there might be a little bit of a retroactive apology so that now people do buy completely into his hype because they underestimated him the last time.
Now, on the subject of Jobs, it's fairly evident, criminally or not, that he was a participant in the backdating of stock options for compensation of top Apple executives. No charges have been filed, but it's a big mess for him. And yet, this week, when the iPhone was introduced, it seemed to all just fade into the background.
He does seem to really have a Teflon coating, and I think it's because he's sort of this iconic business hero. You know, he came from nothing. He didn't complete his college education. He just had this masterful knowledge of knowing what people want and need. And so when he does something that is pretty evidently unethical or potentially even criminal, people don't want to believe it. And a reason not to believe it is that he's capable of bringing forth the iPhone, if that makes any sense at all. How could someone bring such beauty into the world and also be flawed? And it's ridiculous that journalists could take their eye off the ball that way, but I also think it's incredibly human.
I looked at much of the coverage of this introduction and found exactly one piece that evinced any sort of skepticism about whether this thing is the real deal. Is the thing so transcendent that it defies any kind of negative publicity?
What's really funny is that all of the incredibly positive coverage that the iPhone has received has come with barely anyone actually touching it. You know, it's a device that's about manipulation with your fingers. But at Macworld, Apple keeps it under lock and key. It's in a glass case like a rare diamond. You can't really find flaws with something when you've only seen it demonstrated by the great and terrible Jobs.
All right, Pete. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
Pete Mortensen co-authors The Cult of Mac blog for Wired.com. The American media may gush over anything Apple throws their way, but Big Oil is not so lucky. Even with friendly leadership on Capitol Hill, it faced an often unfriendly public. Now that the Democrats have stormed Congress with plans for reducing oil company subsidies and imposing carbon dioxide emissions caps, energy industries are braced for a regulatory battering the likes of which they haven't seen in decades. And so, reports the Wall Street Journal, they're waging a battle for hearts and minds. John Fialca co-wrote the Journal article. He says that readers of wonky rags such as the Washington Post or the National Journal will be sure to notice the new public relations push.
It started out with the American Petroleum Institute, which began a big advertising campaign shortly after the Hurricane Katrina tore up the oil fields and oil rigs in the Gulf of Mexico. As they explain it, they felt that they did an heroic job in getting gasoline supplies back online and there weren't any major shortages, which is true. But they felt, you know, the public really didn't appreciate that. And as soon as gasoline prices began to rise at the pump, then they began to see themselves demonized as big oil. And, of course, their big profits didn't help them any in that regard. And so they began the first of what appears to be a long-range, as they call it, public education campaign.
Is what we're going to see in the next few weeks and months just a continuation of the existing campaign, or will there be specific attempts to influence Congress?
Oh, I think this is all intended to influence Congress. The problem is the industry and the companies involved don't have the access to the committee chairman and the policymakers that they used to. And so they're trying to do it by going at the literate public, I guess is the way I would put it. I'll give you one example. One of their ads says, you've heard all this talk about big oil. Well, oil companies need to be big because they only hold about 6% of the world's oil reserves, and they need to bargain with state-owned oil companies in nations like Saudi Arabia to get access to the rest. And that requires a certain amount of bigness, high technology, and money.
Well, that's actually an interesting point. Now, you cover energy. Is it a relevant point? Is it misdirection? Is that information that should change any legislator's opinion of how to vote on big oil?
Well, I would hope it would get them beyond the slogans. I mean, the sloganeering that we heard last summer was that big oil is ripping you off at the gas pump. It was kind of a one-sided argument because it didn't point out that the oil price is set internationally by a cartel of governments. And also, you've got other big governments like China who are bidding against us in the market. So it's a complicated picture. And both sides seem to want to, you know, short-circuit that with handy slogans. But people have to sit down and understand both sides of the equation.
Now, we've talked so far about big oil. What about the electricity lobby? Do they have a dog in this fight?
Oh, big dogs. Several, as a matter of fact. 50% of our electricity comes from coal-fired power plants. Coal would be one of the big targets of mandatory carbon dioxide controls because they produce about a third of the nation's CO2 emissions. Part of their campaign, and they don't have a really well-heeled advertising campaign going, but they're thinking of doing one, would be jobs. That in the small towns in coal country, lowering emissions would create a loss of jobs and a huge economic impact in small-town America. And their complaint is that people in big-town America, where a lot of the new Democrat chairmen come from, don't understand this. They also raise the flag for small business and industries where if you raise their electricity rates a bit, they'll have to shut down because they can't compete with foreign competitors who have cheaper electricity or who don't have the kind of mandatory pollution controls that we do.
So I guess the ultimate question here is this going to help? Do you think this sort of lobbying one or two steps removed is going to influence any single person on Capitol Hill?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think we still have a concerned public out there that is attempting to be literate on this issue. I don't know if they'll read all the ads, but, you know, they'll really worry about their interests and about their businesses and their jobs. On the other hand, you have some very thoughtful people among the new chairman coming into Congress, and they want to look good in the long run, and slogans really aren't helpful in the long run, and so I think they will fight.
Okay, John. Many thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
John Fialca covers the energy industry for The Wall Street Journal.
Coming up, media under the microscope and sending messages through cyberspace in secret.
This is On the Media from NPR.
If you can hear me right now, then you're listening to the podcast, and we were one of the first national radio shows to offer a podcast. The thing is, it's free for you, but it costs us money. So, would you consider sending our station, WNYC, a little extra to help pay for it? Just go to WNYC.org and let them know that our podcast matters to you.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In his speech this week, President Bush again accused Iran and Syria of supporting the Iraqi insurgency and is unlikely to ever sit down with the leaders of those countries. But according to the AP, the Syrian government wants to engage with Washington in hopes that the new Congress will push for talks. If the White House ever does talk, it will have to be with the administration of Bashar al-Assad, who assumed the presidency in 2000 following his father's 3 decades in the job. When the young Assad ascended, he promised to make Syria, quote, a contemporary and progressive society. But 6 years and a war in Iraq later, Syria doesn't seem to have progressed much. Guy Taylor, international news editor for the online World Politics Watch, went to Damascus to see if the Syrian internet could serve as a gauge to test whether freedom really is on the march. He wrote in the current issue of Reason magazine that the gauge is delivering ambiguous readings. Consider the following remark made to Taylor by Syria's Minister of Telecommunications and Technology, Amer Nasir Salem.
We're moving towards opening up much more than closing down. Two things are not allowed. One is anything that ignites ethnic unrest. The second one is that if somebody goes with another country against his country, Syria is currently under attack, and if somebody writes or publishes or whatever something that supports the attack, they will be tried.
So, Guy, who is Amer Nasir Salem?
Salem is the Syrian Minister of Telecommunications and Technology. He's been in the job for about a year. And I believe that he went to high school with Bashar Assad, the Syrian president. Salem has kind of an interesting story because he worked in the United States for, I think, 6 or 7 years as a senior programs manager for Microsoft. It's something of a coup that Bashar Assad brought him into this role because Assad, prior to his father's death, had the only really serious political role that he had had in Syria was as the head of something called the Syrian Computer Society, which is sort of a place for Baathists who are very excited about technology and computers to talk about ways that Syrian society might merge with telecommunications and the internet.
It sounds like Bashar al-Assad and Salem were both quite open to the West, and yet Salem's comment, as we heard it, suggests that they haven't exactly imbibed the notion that the internet should be a riot of free speech.
Absolutely. Salem, I got the sense that he understands very well that a fully open media would open the window for very aggressive public challenges to Bashar Assad's regime. And I use the term regime carefully because it is a mafia-style dictatorship.
Nevertheless, you do suggest that there is some ambiguity there. It isn't all bad. And in fact, you say that it appeared that things might be opening up a bit before the war in Iraq.
Well, prior to the U.S. invasion, there was definitely a period known as the Damascus Spring in which Assad's government allowed for websites to open and cover local news with criticism of the government, as well as a handful of private magazines. When it became clear that the United States would invade Iraq, the Assad government began holding its cards a little closer to its chest and definitely working from the fear that total chaos could break out in Iraq and spread to Syria, began clamping down on private media and free flow of information on websites.
So let's unpack the nature of Syrian internet censorship. You suggest that it takes place on a variety of levels. There's a certain amount of self-censorship on the part of writers. There are web filters. You wrote that all websites from Israel are blocked. Mm-hmm. So to some degree, pressure is put on both sides of the information flow, on what the people post on the internet as well as what they can access, right?
Absolutely. There's something of a culture of fear that exists among young users because stories and rumors swirl about people disappearing or being arrested for posting political things on blogs. So young users will make their blogs apolitical or not political. Or they'll be careful, for instance, to include a map on the blog that shows Syria without the presence of Israel, just to make it clear to a government censor that, well, this is a website that might have some critical views, but it's obviously someone who understands or appreciates Syrian nationalism in the respect of denying the existence of Israel.
I thought one of the most chilling aspects of the story that you present is the fact that there aren't any rules. Then you really do have to impose a kind of extreme discipline on yourself, and that smacks of the worst kind of totalitarianism.
Absolutely. any web user or journalist always will have it in the back of their mind that if they aren't paying very close attention to the whims of the government and what could be considered forbidden material, that they could find themselves in a great deal of trouble very quickly. For that reason, people definitely embrace a degree of self-censorship.
So to sum up, the internet is not going to usher in an age of freedom of speech and access to information in Syria.
At the same time, people are excited about the possibility that there's more information available about what's happening in Syria and the region, and they've also got an online forum through blogs and chat rooms to talk about it publicly without even giving their identity. I think there's a great deal of hope and optimism involved in bringing this technology to the masses.
Guy, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Guy Taylor is an editor for the web daily World Politics Watch. To hear his entire interview with Amer Nazir Salem, visit onthemedia.org. His story, After the Damascus Spring, is in the February issue of Reason magazine.
Whether you sit in your cube all day watching YouTube videos or I Am Friends or blog about politics, you take unfettered access to the internet for granted. That's because you don't live in Syria or China or Saudi Arabia or any of the 40-some countries that censor the net. For years, human rights groups and techies have sought a way around government snooping, and they may have found it. It's called Siphon, a sort of social network in which the individual nodes are actual computers set up in non-censoring countries to be used remotely and untraceably by the online repressed. Ron Diebert directs the University of Toronto's Citizen Lab, where Siphon was developed. He says that before Siphon, there were other ways of getting around online censorship.
In the past, the primary method that people used was to create, in uncensored countries, large public proxies, a series of computers whose addresses were publicized over chats or forums or even over the radio, and citizens within censored countries were encouraged to connect to them and surf the web freely. They work for the most part. The problem is really twofold. One is that just as citizens can find out about connecting to these proxies, so can the governments. And as soon as the governments find out about them, they put those proxies on a blacklist. So it's a constant cat and mouse game, and new proxies have to be set up. The other shortcoming, in some cases, is that the traffic is in plain text, easily intercepted and monitored by the authorities. So in essence, you're setting up a honeypot to encourage people to go to computers to get around internet censorship, and in doing so, kind of corralling them into areas where the authorities can identify them if they choose to do so. So prior methods to Siphon were both inefficient and insecure, I would say.
So tell me about Siphon. Tell me about its origins as a project and essentially how it works.
Siphon works by leveraging social networks of trust among individuals who span censored and uncensored locations. And that can include everything from friends and family members and ethnic diaspora communities, Iranian Americans, Chinese Americans, and so forth. It can include journalists, businesses, non-governmental organizations. The way it works is by having an individual install Siphon on their computer in the uncensored location, and then give the unique username, password, and address for that computer to someone or a group of people who lives in a censored country, have them connect to that computer as if they were there and surf the internet freely and securely. The connection between the censored location and the uncensored location runs over an encrypted channel, an HTTPS connection. So it's both encrypted, meaning secure, and also distributed below the radar screen, making it very hard for authorities to identify.
And then someone who was in a censored country who was signing on to, let's say, my computer to use it as a proxy would not leave any kind of electronic trail?
Well, there is no software to install on your computer. So at a most basic level, there is no program to identify for users. And we encourage people to, as a matter of practice, erase the cache on their browser once they're finished their Siphon session, so that if their computer is confiscated, authorities would have no means to identify that they've been using Siphon.
Now, are you anticipating that large numbers of people in the uncensored world will actually dedicate specific computers to being proxy points of entry for those in the censored world?
Well, that's exactly what happened. I mean, we released Siphon on December 1st, and within a week, I think we had 30,000 downloads of Siphon software. But yeah, the response has been enormous. And I've had emails from the human rights community, ethnic diaspora communities, Vietnamese associations, Iranians. They translated Siphon into their own languages. We've had journalists who have been using Siphon because, of course, they have to operate in countries where internet censorship is common.
One more question. There's 40 countries on the list. Are there any surprises in the 40?
The surprises have really been in the nature of internet censorship practices themselves. First of all, the extent to which Western, mostly U.S., commercial filtering products are used by countries that filter the internet. Off-the-shelf commercial products that are sold to businesses and schools and public libraries in the United States and Western Europe and so on are now being used by countries like Iran and Yemen and Burma to filter citizens' access to information. And these companies are in turn tailoring their products to best suit that market. To give you one example, one of the commercial filtering products that we've been examining has a category called advocacy that blocks access to websites of organizations that promote opposition to the government. So that clearly that is a category of websites that's tailor-made for non-democratic regimes. That to me is a very troubling trend.
Well, Ron, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ron Diebert is director of Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto.
What you know about the world depends largely on what you see or hear in the news. And judging from our own mail, the public's biggest beef with the news media centers on how much certain stories are covered or not covered. But news consumers can never really know for sure unless they actually count the words individual news outlets devote to, say, the war in Iraq or dead dictators. Which is exactly what the Project for Excellence in Journalism is now doing, a close dissection of 48 different media outlets compiled and charted this week and every week in their News Coverage Index. PEJ Associate Director Mark Jerkowitz says it's the largest study of the news media ever attempted, and he joins us now. Mark, welcome to the show.
It's good to be here, Brooke. Thank you.
So I'm guessing that someone has to read the New York Times every morning, listen to Rush Limbaugh every afternoon, watch the CBS Evening News every night, in addition to 40-odd other outlets throughout the week, and tally and log the content. Am I right in this?
You are right. It's not just someone. It's actually 8 professional coders who are sort of the heart and soul of this operation, who are monitoring 48 different media outlets, not only capturing them, but literally maintaining them so that we, at any point in time, can actually put our hands on those stories. Then those are going to be the best informed people in the United States of America.
You know, I have to say, it sounds like torture. You know, do they get to, like, take an hours of exercise in the yard?
Well, I think we do allow them visits from relatives and occasional letters.
So we talked about the New York Times, Rush Limbaugh, CBS Evening News. Are there any selections in there that might surprise some listeners?
We're picking some small newspapers like the Chattanooga Times Free Press and the Bakersfield Californian. We're picking a number of websites like CNN and MSNBC, but we're also picking some of the aggregators like Yahoo and Google. We're picking a lot of the cable talk shows, including Sean Hannity, Michael Savage, and on the liberal side, Ed Schultz and Randy Rhodes. So we've picked some of the obvious suspects simply because of their reach and power and authority, but we think we have a good mix.
Okay, so your first report, which came out on Tuesday, examined the preceding week's coverage. That's December 31st to January 5th. And it's typically a slow news week in most years, a kind of holiday hangover, but not so much this year.
No, we had 3 interesting developments in that particular week that kind of changed the tone a little bit. One was obviously the new Democratic Congress, which turned out to be the top story of the week. And on some level, that's kind of a symbolic ceremonial story. But the mere fact that Nancy Pelosi became the first female Speaker of the House made it, I think, a bigger story than it would naturally be. And then we had 2 other big stories that made it into the top 5 that were essentially the deaths of 2 world, very different world leaders. The death and the tributes to the former president, the 38th president, I think exceeded what a lot of people thought we were going to get. There was a lot of pomp and circumstance coverage, but there seemed to be something else in the coverage, too, which was sort of a a longing for Ford's kind of Midwestern decency and moderation this particular era. And then maybe the real surprise story of the week that snuck into the top five was the execution of Saddam Hussein, which might have, under normal circumstances, been a one-day story. After all, there wasn't a tremendous amount of coverage of the trial. But clearly, and we've seen this happen before, when the cell phone video emerged showing the taunting and the actual execution of Saddam Hussein, it became one of the top five stories of the week. So it was a surprisingly newsworthy week.
I thought it was really interesting how different kinds of stories got different kinds of coverage in different kinds of mediums. Specifically, the funeral of President Ford was covered least in the newspapers.
Yeah, there was really a lot of time taken up simply in the ceremonial aspects of his death on television that you just don't see on newspapers. That was certainly a very interesting distinction. One of the things we're also finding out is that online media give Americans the widest range of international news, at least the online media that we chose. And for example, two stories that really didn't make it up above the radar screen, the fighting in Somalia with the Ethiopian attack on the Islamists in Somalia, as well as the disappeared Indonesian plane crash, were top five stories online. Yet they didn't really crack that list anywhere else. So we are seeing some interesting distinctions.
You know, one thing that was really missing for me in your index was a breakdown, not just simply by medium, but also by individual outlet. An example, how did NPR's Morning Edition differ from, say, the Washington Post? Wouldn't that be helpful?
It certainly would, and that's actually one of the goals. Right now, obviously, we're looking at sector versus sector, but there is nothing to stop us from coming out with a study that says effectively, hey, we've looked at 2-3 months of the coverage of the war in Iraq. Here's how the Washington Post differs from the New York Times, or here's how Bill O'Reilly differs from Keith Olbermann. And there's one other thing I should mention while we're on this subject, which is that Andrew Kohut, who does the polling at the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press, will be going out in the field on a regular basis to do his news interest index, in which he fundamentally asks people, what are you paying attention to? What news stories are you interested in? We're going to, in some way, shape, and form, match that up against our news coverage index. And hopefully, we're going to be able to get a sense of whether or not the media and the public are in sync over what constitutes important and newsworthy information.
All right. Mark, thanks very much.
Brooke, my pleasure.
Mark Jerkowitz is the Associate Director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, PEJ's News Coverage Index, will be published every Tuesday at journalism.org.
Coming up, Fox News Channel's ratings dip, but that hardly spells the end of hate TV.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, featuring a new book by Carl Schramm, The Entrepreneurial Imperative, at kauffman.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, exploring how technology is changing kids and learning, at digitallearning.macfound.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Many bloggers across the political spectrum say that part of their job is to keep the mainstream media, or MSM, honest. For example, the conservative blogosphere was happy to claim the scalp of former CBS anchor Dan Rather for using forged memos to discount the president's National Guard service. But liberal bloggers charge that for every right-wing gotcha that pans out, there are 20 wild allegations that don't. A recent case involves a source often cited by the Associated Press, an Iraqi police officer called Jamil Hussein. After he was the sole source cited in a contested AP story, the rightosphere claimed he didn't exist. The AP stonewalled, and the clamor grew louder. He was finally found. Turns out the AP was using a pseudonym to protect him. Now the leftosphere is crowing. Meanwhile, some conservative bloggers, mired in the ugly truth about the war in Iraq, are wondering whether they should have spent less time attacking the MSM and more time believing it. We thought we'd get into the argument, so we've enlisted prominent conservative blogger Ed Morrissey, a.k.a. Captain Ed. We'll take the position of, surprise, surprise, the liberal blogs. Ed, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much.
So last month, Rich Lowry, who is the editor of the National Review Online, wrote a column accusing his brothers-in-arms, fellow conservatives, of being overly skeptical of the mainstream media. He wrote, and I've got a quote, "In their distrust of the mainstream media and their defensiveness over President Bush and the war, many conservatives lost touch with reality on Iraq." Do you agree with Lowry?
Well, I think it's a feeling among some people in the blogosphere that they have been burned enough by the media that they have a blanket sort of hostility towards it. But it's a little too easy to just say, well, the whole media is biased and untruthful, and therefore we can't trust anything they say.
How do you feel that conservative bloggers or just conservatives in general got burned?
We've seen the Rathergate memo issue, the Eason Jordan admission that CNN was basically in the bag for Saddam Hussein up until the time that he was deposed by the American invasion. And those are certainly very clear examples of mainstream media outlets not delivering the truth.
But it does seem as if bloggers on the right have turned these gotchas into a sweeping indictment of the MSM and its supposed agenda.
I think it's a little much to say that every single person in the media is biased against the conservatives, and therefore nothing that we see in the newspapers or the television or any other media can be trusted at all. I certainly think that there are plenty of people out there who are practicing agenda journalism, but there are also plenty of people out there who are practicing very good journalism. One of the people that I'm thinking of course, would be the New York Times' John Burns. Now, the New York Times is not necessarily my favorite source for news media, but John Burns has done an excellent job and reporting out of Iraq.
But these sweeping indictments seem to keep coming. Recently, Stanley Kurtz, who is a fellow at the Hoover Institution, wrote that, quote, "Conservative distrust of the media's very real bias has inclined us to dismiss reports about problems in Iraq that are real. And in the end, the media bear fundamental responsibility for this."
Well, take a look at the Jamil Hussein issue that came up. The AP used him for 61 stories between April and November. And in this last story in which they used him about the burning of the four mosques and the six people who were supposedly burned alive, people went to other news sources, including, by the way, the New York Times, who said that they never heard of the story and there was no evidence that had ever existed. And so the bloggers asked, where is Jamil Hussein? Who is this one source, the single source that AP used for that story? And they couldn't produce him.
Well, you could accuse the AP of sloppily reporting that story. But the obsession within the rightosphere was that he didn't exist. The fraud we know as Jamal Hussein, Floppy Aces called him. The Little Green Footballs website called him AP's non-existent news source.
Well, I would tell you this. I think it was a mistake to assume that Jamil Hussein did not exist. And in this case, that damaged their credibility. And I wrote that the other day. I'm not saying that from this point forward, we should never, ever, ever trust the AP. I cite the AP. I probably cite the AP dozens of times a week because I write a lot of posts. I'm just saying that if they're using single-sourced stories, their track record is somewhat spotty.
And yet it was in the rightosphere that Democrats were accused of inventing a fake Republican National Committee memo regarding the Terri Schiavo controversy, which turned out to be authored by Republicans, and also accused an AP photographer, Bilal Hussein, of photographing an ongoing execution on the streets of Baghdad, even though he had nothing to do with those photographs. If you were looking for facts, would you be more likely to believe ones that are cited without much evidence in a blog or ones that were cited without much evidence in the AP?
If you put it that way, I would say the AP. There are bloggers that I know who are very, very outstanding in making sure that they are as accurate as they possibly can be, and military bloggers especially. I think both sides are a little hypocritical in pointing to each other and saying, you're not trustworthy. But if you're saying generic blog versus the AP, I mean, the AP has got, 100 years of a reputation for gathering news.
And do you agree with Stanley Kurtz when he says the mainstream media are to blame for the right-wing bloggers not believing what they said about Iraq, which was true?
We are all big boys and girls. And just like when we go into a store to buy a car, when it turns out that we bought a Yugo, we can't turn around and say, but all the advertising told us it was great. You have to do some homework. You have to look into what it is that you're buying. And if you're not doing that, then that's your fault.
And I guess the lesson here for all news consumers in whatever form would simply be caveat emptor.
Otherwise, you wind up with the Yugo.
Ed, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke. It's been great.
Ed Morrissey blogs at captainsquartersblog.com and is the host of a Saturday afternoon talk show on the Northern Alliance Radio Network, AM 1280 in the Twin Cities. Buyer beware is probably the best advice we can offer news consumers these days. But for those who would rather buy in bulk, for those who prefer to be told what is right and who is wrong, there's always Fox News. Here's anchor Gretchen Carlson on Wednesday with White House counselor Dan Bartlett.
Dan, you talk about a hostile enemy obviously being Iraq, but hostile enemies right here on the home front. Yesterday, Senator Ted Kennedy proposing that any kind of a troop surge should mean that there should be congressional approval of that.
Bartlett answered that he didn't view Senator Kennedy as a hostile enemy. Maybe so, but there's little doubt that for the Bush administration, Fox is friendly territory. We got more evidence of that on Thursday when somebody forgot to turn off a mic on Condoleezza Rice, and Reuters caught the secretary saying, quote, "My Fox guys, I love every single one of them."
It makes sense that as President Bush stumbles in the polls, the network that hitched itself to his fortunes will stumble too. And sure enough, in the last quarter of 2006, Fox News saw a 14% drop in its viewership and a 20% fall off in primetime compared to the previous year. Meanwhile, MSNBC's liberal Countdown with Keith Olbermann gained audience share. Fox News is still by far cable's leader of the pack, but still, Rolling Stone contributor Matt Taibbi has noticed a sigh of relief on the part of a lot of media commentators. He wrote about it in his online column last month.
Some of the commentators took the tack, saying that what happened to Fox was a repudiation of their formula for securing an audience, that people were somehow tired of hate media, tired of that kind of invective. Whereas, I think actually the opposite is true. I mean, some of the people that they lost market share to were of the same kind of shouting and hating style. People like Glenn Beck from CNN, Headline News. Either that or they were simply the opposite political orientation. You know, Fox sort of became famous and became a major media power by having a lot of shows like The O'Reilly Factor that focused heavily on demonizing a liberal enemy. And I think you started to have some shows from the opposite end of the spectrum, like Keith Olbermann's show on MSNBC, which to some degree did the same thing in reverse for liberal audiences.
Now, the formula you referred to in your piece, you called blame, hate, coalesce. Explain for me the dynamic of blame, hate, coalesce.
You aim for a very broad segment of the populace, say, middle-class conservatives or middle-American conservatives, and you do two things. You show them that their way of life is being threatened, and then you give them somebody who they can blame for their way of life being threatened. You know, so you fill their news with terrible and threatening news, and then you, in the same broadcast, do something like show a lot of pictures of gay people getting married on the steps of the Massachusetts State House. And then in the end, it becomes sort of a team building exercise where people tune into that radio station, not so much to hear that news, but to hear other people like themselves tuned in so that they can feel like they're part of something, like part of a group.
So a Fox News channel's formula is to find out what its audience is willing to hate, and then feed them enough material to make their blood boil.
Right.
Are you saying that others on the political left are doing essentially the same thing?
Yeah, but there's a step in between there, too. I think what happened before there were shows for people on the left that did the same thing was that people who were not necessarily on the political left, but just not of that group, tuned into shows like O'Reilly and Michael Savage and found themselves sort of inadvertently lumped in to the enemy category and were offended. They may not have necessarily had a whole lot in common before that, but after a while, you get a group of people who do have something in common. They're all enemies of Bill O'Reilly, or they're all enemies of Michael Savage. And then for some canny media organization, all they have to do is craft an audience around that. And you get, you know, books like Sweet Jesus, I Hate Bill O'Reilly. You get all those books like Brainless about Ann Coulter. And then before you know it, you just have these two insoluble groups who just keep butting heads against each other and are terminally paranoid about each other's existences. The problem for me personally is that I have absolutely no credibility in this area because that's exactly what I do for a living. I mean, I'm I'm sort of an ad hominem expert for Rolling Stone, and I didn't include myself in this piece because I thought it would be pretentious to sort of write about myself as having participated in the destruction of the American political landscape. But, you know, like a lot of reporters and like a lot of op-ed columnists, we're under a lot of pressure to sort of rile people up and create controversies, and that's what we do.
Who's the victim in this ecosystem of hate versus hate?
Well, I think we all are, especially the people who are the audiences of these shows. You know, and I've seen this in families. You know, you have one uncle who listens to Rush and another uncle who listens to Air America, and they don't talk to each other anymore. People who are neighbors, you know, they're far more likely to go turn on the O'Reilly show or listen to, you know, whatever, you know, radio show that appeals to him than they are to go next door and talk to the neighbor who they think might be of an opposite political orientation. We've gotten to the point where we've instructed our audiences to really believe that they are the sum of their political beliefs, that if you are a follower of a certain political ideology, you can never under any circumstances mix with a person who doesn't believe in those things. And it's just not true. I mean, there's a lot more to all of us than the way we vote or what we believe in politically. That's an obvious truism, and it sounds pious to point that out. But the thing is, you never hear that on the news or in any of these shows. You never hear it said that, yeah, we disagree, but it's just not that big a deal in the end. And there's a reason why they don't say that, because that would spoil the entire formula.
All right, Matt. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Bob.
Matt Taibbi is a contributing editor for Rolling Stone magazine.
Be fairly accused of beating up on cable news, but it's hard to resist when cable news beats up on itself. Case in point, the O'Reilly-Olbermann smackdown in the spring of 2006. MSNBC's Keith Olbermann has a weekly segment called The Worst Person in the World, an honor he awarded day after day to Fox News's Bill O'Reilly. Last April, O'Reilly finally cracked. He said anyone who spoke Olbermann's name on his program would hear from Fox Security, and apparently at least one caller to his radio show actually did. At the time of the smackdown, we gathered real tape of the feuding hosts, set their voices to music, and, yeah, embellished just a little. Think of it as behind the music for cable news nerds.
Like all MC rivalries, at the heart of the battle between Olbermann and O'Reilly is money, fame, and street cred. Their cable news shows compete for the 8 p.m. slot. Ultimately, the success of one hinges on the destruction of the other.
I think the real war began when Keith started calling him Ted Baxter. And then he included O'Reilly in the worst person segment 16 times. 16 times! I told him, Keith, you're declaring war. And he just laughed. I tried to warn him.
O'Reilly banned anyone from mentioning Olbermann's name on his show. Things turned ugly when Mike from Orlando called into O'Reilly's radio show and tried to mention Olbermann. Mike's line was cut, and a few days later, the O'Reilly crew released the chilling single, He's a Gone Guy.
You're in the no-spin zone with Bill O'Reilly.
Believe it. We have your phone numbers, by the way. Believe it. Because we're not going to play around. You will be held accountable. Believe it. So if you're listening, Mike, we have your phone number, and we're going to turn it over to Fox Security, and you'll be getting a little visit. Believe it. No, maybe Mike's going to get in big trouble. There you go. Mike is, he's a gone guy.
In the track, O'Reilly and his crew threaten to sic Fox Security on anyone who gets in their way. Shepard Smith makes an eerie cameo at the end of the cut.
He's a gone guy. Believe it.
No, O'Reilly's angry. Where's Olbermann? Let's just throw something at Olbermann, Bill.
The The O'Reilly crew performed He's a Gone Guy 2 weeks later at the Peabody's in front of an amped-up crowd of broadcast executives.
I think we should all be that we meant business. I mean, come on, they're on MSNBC. Who do they think they are?
But Ol B, as he now goes by, fired back with his own song, Threatening Behavior. He openly mocked the O'Reilly crew, further feeding the flames.
Oh, here we go.
Cut him off. Expurgated. Erased. It's a radio show. Even if a caller swears, it's a radio show. What do you mean you'll be getting a little visit? What do you mean we have your phone numbers? Bill thinks he has his own police. Radio show over here, trip to Gitmo over there. Why are you always smearing him, Bill?
That is an abuse of Bill O'Reilly's power, and it's an attempt. He's crossed the line. It's an abuse of the media, it's an abuse of law enforcement, and he's now the one engaging in threatening behavior.
At a Peabody after party, violence broke out when O'Reilly's Fox security roughed up Olby's posse. No one was wounded, but a producer's dress was damaged, and Olby's hair was mussed.
Keith's hair just didn't have to get mussed like that. Keith's hair is great. I wish it hadn't gone down this way.
As we said, those were the voices of the actual hosts. We made up the songs and the part about the Peabody's.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer, with engineering help from Rob Christensen. We had more help from Alicia Rebensdorf, Michael McLaughlin, and Mark Phillips. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org, where you can also sign up for our newsletter. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
I don't know what it is, but I want it.
On the Media is supported by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org. And thanks.